Welcome, everyone, to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lahav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic correspondent, and I'm here with Yaakov Katz, editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post. We're going to open by discussing the tragic events in Surfside, Florida, north of Miami, where a building collapsed and 159 people were missing. Some of the bodies have been recovered since then. At the moment, there's an Israeli search and rescue team from the IDF. They're on the ground helping in the efforts. Israeli Diaspora Minister Nachman Shai flew to Florida as well to comfort and show support because many of the victims are Jewish. It's a large and growing Jewish community there. Yaakov, you were saying you saw some interesting responses to Shai's.
Well, I mean, I was just following on social media and I saw Nachman Shai's visit, which is really just after he was sworn in as the new minister of diaspora. And there were people who were criticizing him and saying, why does Israel even need to send aid? Why does it need to send the Home Front Command delegation there? Why does Nachman Shai need to go there? It's just a trip for him to enjoy himself in Florida and you know, in Surfside and in the sunny Southern Florida beaches. And to me, it's ridiculous. Like, how are there still people out there who don't get the value and the importance of Israel displaying solidarity, not just with the United States at large in face of this great humanitarian disaster by sending a delegation to show the U.S. and the American people that here in Israel, we stand with you. You are our closest ally. We like to say that there's no greater friend for America than Israel. So there's that aspect of it. And then there's the deeper aspect of many of the people who are missing and who are feared dead are Jews. And Israel, as the homeland for the Jewish people, as the Jewish state, has a responsibility to at least show a sympathy and solidarity and a sense of peoplehood, to share that and display that with Jewish people who are in trouble, no matter where they are around the world. And it blows my mind that people still are missing the value in that. I think this is just some, you know, joy trip by Nachman Shai and IDF Home Front Command soldiers to Florida.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the job of the diaspora minister. That is what he is supposed to do, is strengthen the ties between Israel and the Jewish diaspora. And sometimes that includes, you know, during times of tragedies and disasters like this one. So, you know, I when you told me that, I was on the one hand shocked. On the other hand, unfortunately, in some ways it's not surprising, because there are Israelis who, you know, don't have much of a connection to the diaspora and therefore don't necessarily understand its values, its value. You know, whether they just don't have a lot of family, or, you know, if they travel abroad, it's not really to Jewish communities and they just don't get it. Although I do think overwhelmingly, like, the response has been positive in Israel. I also have not seen a negative response outside Israel. I don't think that anybody's, like, you know, protesting the search and rescue team. And I saw, you know, Governor Ron DeSantis, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, all saying that the Israeli team has been a really big help and that they have a lot of experience that their local teams didn't have, especially, you know, in light of Israel opening, you know, field hospitals and doing rescue missions in Haiti when that big earthquake happened. You know, the other thing is, it's not just a diaspora issue. It is a soft power issue for Israel. You know, right. This is maybe the less, like, nice and, you know, brotherly explanation. But, you know, in diplomacy and in foreign relations, there's a concept of soft power. There's a concept of Israel creating a positive image for itself. And when we help people around the world, it does help Israel look better in the eyes of those people. So it has a value in that sense as well.
I think for sure. And I think that what people are missing, and by the way, this is a challenge for this government. I know that the past governments have tried to work on this, but it could be that they actually need to invest some more, is educating Israelis about the average Israeli about the importance of what does peoplehood mean? What does it mean to share responsibility, to have a shared destiny with Jews, even if they come from other places? And there's also this sentiment. I was just reading tweets on Twitter by people who were saying, these are citizens of the greatest, most powerful country in the world. They don't need our help. What could we possibly do? This is arrogance, as if we can send people there and make a difference. it's not just about, first of all, maybe we can make a difference. Maybe we do, as Israel, have experience that they can manage and use and utilize to their advantage, that they have less experience in Florida with these types of disasters than we do. I don't know. So that's number one. And number two, again, it's a display of friendship. It's a demonstration and an illustration of the alliance between our two countries. And it's also a shared responsibility for when Jews are in trouble, the Jewish state offers a hand of help, offers a hug, puts an arm around you, right? That is something that I think people need to recognize has value. And of course, there's the soft power aspect that you spoke about, just the diplomatic benefit that also comes from it. Israel crosses the world to send humanitarian aid, right? I mean, there's Haiti and there's Kenya and there's India and there's Turkey and Indonesia. I mean, where have we not sent aid over the years, from tsunamis to earthquakes to forest fires, right? That's what Israel does.
Yeah, and I think it has immense value. I also really just find this idea that like ministers shouldn't travel to be very silly. Like, I don't think for the most part that Israeli politicians are so extravagant in their foreign travel. And yet, like every year, maybe not last year because of Corona, but every year or so, the like Israeli tabloids will have some sort of article over who spent the most days abroad. But they're doing things, even if the average Israeli doesn't care, like they are doing things that are important to their job and are important to Israel's standing in the world. And like the idea that Nachman Shai, who, by the way, was a professor at Emory through the entire Corona year, so he was in Georgia, like if he wanted to see the beach in Florida, he could have done that then. Like, that's not the reason for this trip. It's just like, it's ridiculous that people make that kind of accusation.
You know, talking about the travels of ministers, there is something in Israel over the years of I think you're right, of people opening up a sore eye, if we could call it that, at ministers and how they travel, and prime ministers, and why does the prime minister need a bed installed on an airplane, and why does he need his wife to go with him? This was always complaints that people heard about Netanyahu, and why does Israel need an Air Force One? And you know, here's President Rivlin, who now is in Washington, in New York this week, and he flew on a commercial flight, and why can't the prime minister fly on commercial flights? As if there's something about this country that we need to take pride in our political state leaders suffering when traveling overseas. It just,
yeah,
it always amazes me. Like if they fly in coach in the back of the plane, in the back row where the seat doesn't even recline, it makes us proud, as opposed to them flying in front in a bed that you know, reclined seat that they can actually sleep before they land and hit the ground running to do media and diplomatic meetings and to meet the president and to meet the UN Secretary General or whatever it might be. Like, shouldn't we want them to be well rested before they go into a meeting?
You know, years ago, I think it must have been like 2013, 2012, something like that, when the prime minister's plane was like up for a vote and they were authorizing those plans, I wrote an article in Hebrew where I had done the math of like how much it costs for each flight, you know, for the planes to be adjusted for the security needs and the bed and everything, and then how much it would cost to have, for the prime minister to have his own plane, which I believe it's a repurposed plane from another country. And it came out that like within 7 or 8 years, like the plane would pay for itself as compared to how much it costs to use a regular flight. So it's not even like an extravagance in that way.
You know, on that topic, the Lav, this week is really a full court diplomatic press by Israel, right? Rivlin, as we mentioned, is in the U.S. He's meeting with Biden. He's going to meet with Guterres, the UN Secretary General, as well as with the Jewish organization heads. Yair Lapid was in Rome the other day meeting with Tony Blinken. He's also traveling to the United Arab Emirates for meetings with the foreign minister and others. The first high-level visit of an Israeli minister, the first minister to visit the UAE since the peace accords were announced last summer.
It's the first official, since last summer, exactly.
Right, so what is all this? What's the background? I mean, you're following these things very closely in these trips. You're traveling with Yair Lapid to the UAE. What is the backdrop for all these meetings that are taking place and conversations right now?
Well, first of all, there's the simple answer, which is that he's new. There's a lot of curiosity. People want to meet him and get a relationship started in order to, you know, continue the positive relationships between the different countries. The other thing going on, though, that's relevant both to Lapid's meeting with Blinken in Rome, also in Rome, Lapid met with the foreign minister of Bahrain. And, you know, he's heading to the UAE, meeting with the foreign minister there. Is Iran is very, very relevant in all of these cases. This is now a sort of break in between the sixth and presumed seventh rounds of indirect negotiations between the U.S. and Iran to return to the 2015 Iran deal. And the Biden administration has indicated that they really want to hear Israel out. Israel has now somewhat shifted its policy, that it's more willing to speak to the U.S. to get into the details of the deal and say, this is where it could be better for us, and this is where it could be better for us, and these sanctions really should stay, which is something that former Prime Minister Netanyahu was not willing to do. He was not willing to engage in any way with the Iran deal because he felt that that would be the legitimizing it. Bennett and Lapid feel otherwise. They feel that they're not going to stop the U.S. from returning to the deal. And they look at, you know, history that shows that Israel did not stop the deal from happening. And therefore, we should try to sort of mitigate the damage. So now is sort of a chance to do that in that meeting with Blinken. And also in the meetings with the foreign ministers of Bahrain and the UAE, the topic of Iran is important because these are all countries that view Iran as, if they don't view it as enemies at the level that Israel does, they certainly view Iran as a strong adversary that they need protection against. And these are countries right. that have historically worked together on that portfolio.
We're going to talk with Amos Yadlin. We have a conversation with Amos Yadlin, the former head of military intelligence, who will weigh in on kind of what Israel's options really are right now with Iran. And can these conversations that are taking place really make a difference for the talks that have been taking place in Vienna? Can Israel impact them? Yadlin not only was the head of military intelligence, but also was one of the pilots who flew in that famous mission back in 1981 to destroy Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor called OC Rock, and was the head of military intelligence when Israel destroyed Syria's nuclear reactor in a place called Al-Kibar. So he does know a bit, a thing or two about taking out nuclear programs. So that'll be interesting. But we're also, you know, this week we've faced a bit of an uptick in COVID, and the city of Modi'in, the city of Binyamina, if I recall correctly, you have family in Modi'in, Lahav. They're okay so far? They haven't been
sent
into isolation and quarantine? No? The Delta variant is spreading throughout Israel. So we'll talk a bit with our coronavirus reporter about Rosella Tarak-Katten, about what is the situation in Israel and how does Israel plan to stop this infection from continuing to spike out of control. With that, we'll begin. So we're honored to have with us Major General Amos Yadlin, who served for a number of years as Israel's head of military intelligence. He was the military attaché to Washington and served in top roles within the Israeli Air Force, was one of the pilots that flew to destroy Saddam Hussein's nuclear reactor in OC Rock 40 years ago back in 1981, and as head of military intelligence was basically the top Israeli intelligence officer in 2007 when Israel destroyed Syria's nuclear reactor in a place called Al-Kibar. So Amos, it's great to have you with us, and we're focusing on Iran this week. We're seeing a full court diplomatic press by Israel on the United States. Foreign Minister Yair Lapid met with the Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Rome. President Rivlin is in Washington for meetings with President Biden. And I'm curious, what do you think Israel can practically expect to get out of the Americans right now? Because we know that the Americans are going back to a deal. What is it that we think we might be able to get them to change?
I think it's a change in the Israeli strategy. Because the Israeli strategy was, we are not talking with the Americans on the details of returning to the deal. We continue with demanding maximum pressure vis-a-vis the Iranians. And the deal is something that we are not even considering to discuss. And this is, Yaakov, as you know, a Republican music. It is not heard in Washington these days. Right. What the new government of Israel decided, And this is, by the way, my recommendation from 2015, is to tell the Americans what we think about the agreement, that this is a very problematic agreement. However, to go to the positive side of the very strategic objective, that both the United States of America, whoever the president, be it George Bush or Barack Obama or Trump or Biden, all of them are saying our objective that Iran will not have nuclear bomb. And I think we have to go back and reiterate this objective together on the podium, Prime Minister of Israel and President of the United States, and then take another position of the United States of America, which is important for us, saying that the deal needs to be corrected, amended, that we want a longer and stronger and maybe wider deal. This is the language of Secretary of State Tony Blinken in his testimony when he was confirmed. So Israel should see the United States of America as an ally and not as a superpower that are acting against Israel. So after being on the podium together, they have to create a channel, a mechanism to coordinate and more than coordinate, to have a strategy, a common strategy that basically will answer the question, what if the Iranians are not coming back to the JCPOA? Because they are now putting forward a very tough demands from the U.S. What if the United States, after returning to the JCPOA, is unable to amend it to a longer and stronger? And then what the two countries are doing together? And in this case, Israel can also ask America to help prepare other options, which is very, very important. If somebody wants to succeed in a diplomatic effort, he must have a credible military option, both in U.S. and Israel.
So this new government has changed its policy in the way that you mentioned, and Yair Lapid had mentioned that he and Blinken came to an agreement that there would be no surprises. And opposition leader Netanyahu made a big deal about this, saying that it endangers national security, that Israel should always have the freedom to act as it wants. What do you think about this argument that's going on? What should Israel's policy be?
First, on the issue of whether this government really have made the discussion, the very deep and professional discussion on the new policy, I'm not sure. They still have to convey in the cabinet, in the new cabinet, and discuss these very complex and tough and crucial issues. But on the issue of no surprises, I think what the head of the opposition criticized is in a way criticizing himself. Because if you remember, he was the one who offered and pushed in one of the many campaign, I don't remember in which election campaign, he pushed for a formal defense treaty between Israel and the U.S. What's the meaning of this treaty? That nobody surprises each other. On the contrary, we consult, Israeli soldiers will go to Afghanistan and American soldiers will come to protect Israel. Both are, I think, not a good ideas. So my sources are saying that in his first conversation with President Biden, the head of the opposition at that time, Prime Minister, used the same language. We will not surprise each other. And the meaning of no surprising is not an operation to protect Israel. It's mostly in the diplomatic arena. The former prime minister has some problematic memories from Obama administration in 2009 in the NPT convention. Mm-hmm. The U.S. surprised Israel. If you remember the last December 2016 I think it was a UN Security Council Resolution 2334 that the U.S. surprised Israel. And Israel can surprise the U.S. with a new settlement or some other activities. It is limited to the diplomatic arena, not to the military defense arena. Israel has the right to protect itself by itself at the time of its choosing.
Now, on that point, so you kind of hinted that, yes, if you want to get a diplomatic success, you also have to have a credible military option so you can give out a carrot, but you got to hold a big stick. If America goes back into the JCPOA, assuming that these talks in Vienna succeed, at least from the U.S. perspective, is there a type of compensation that Israel could ask the U.S. for? Right? We know, for example, after the recent Gaza operation, Israel used a lot of its GPS-guided smart weapon systems. It needs to replenish those. Israel used up a lot of its Iron Dome, and Biden has already said that they would help replenish those Iron Dome interceptors. Is there more? Could we get new aircraft, maybe even just more money as aid, right? Increase the $3.8 billion that Israel gets every year. Is that something that could offset the risk and danger that comes from the JCPOA return?
Yeah, I think, once again, that we have to look all the time at the objective. The objective is Iran will never have a nuclear bomb. Especially as long as it's called to the destruction of Israel. So what we have vis-a-vis Iran, we have five strategies, by the way, fundamental strategies. One is an agreement, and agreement should be a good agreement, agreement that really block all the Iranians straight to the bomb, not the JCPOA from 2015, who has some very serious loopholes. Second is sanctions that changing the Iranian leadership cost-benefit analysis. Sanctions that telling them if you continue with nuclear activities, the regime may collapse from economic sanctions or other sanctions. The third is strategy C, stand for covert clandestine cyber. All the operations that under the threshold of war. Number four is a strategy of regime change. We can all sleep good at night when India has a nuclear bomb. We don't know any Indian president who called to wipe Israel off the map, and there are not military parades in New Delhi with missiles saying death to Israel. And the last one is, of course, a kinetic attack, as it was done in 1981 or 2007 in Iraq and Syria, respectively. So you have to handle these five strategies, and they are not mutually exclusive. And the U.S., as you stated in your question, should help Israel prepare the last resort. If worst come to worst, agreement is not achieved, sanctions are not imposed, the regime is not changing, strategy C is not achieving critical mass, and Iran is breaking out to the bomb, the U.S. and Israel should agree that one of them should stop Iran, and if it is to be done by Israel, the U.S. should help Israel to prepare first for the kinetic attack, and second, for the consequences. If there is a barrage of missiles as a retaliation, a better missile defense should be prepared, and this is exactly the kind of discussions that I hope the new government will do through their professionals in the IDF, in the Ministry of Defense, Foreign Ministry, National Security Council, with their American counterparts.
So let's talk about this new government. We have the Security Cabinet, which so far so good has met twice in the 2 weeks as it's supposed to meet every week, but didn't for many years. But the members of the cabinet, about half of them have never even been ministers before, let alone security cabinet ministers. And they don't have strong backgrounds in national security. Do you think that's going to be a problem for Israel? How do you think that they should be prepared for their new role?
Yeah, I think there is a very good report by General Yaakov Amidror, who did a study or a report to Prime Minister Netanyahu right after 2014, when at that time, I think Education Minister Bennett said that the cabinet was not prepared well. And I think it's a good opportunity to use the recommendation by Amidror to educate the newcomers. Let me remind you that there are some experienced figures there. Benny Gantz was Minister of Defense. Lieberman was Minister of Defense. Bennett served, even though a very short period. And some of them were in the cabinet for a couple of years. But no doubt that learning and educating yourself and meeting the professionals, the Ramatkal, the head of Mossad, the head of the intelligence agencies, is very important to be prepared. Second, you need to reconsider Israel security concepts, because Israel security concept is a basic for a case-by-case decision. And Israel security concept or doctrine was not updated since 2006. Last time it was updated by Dan Meridor, head of committee for defense minister at that time, Shaul Mofaz. And they have to speak about scenarios and possibilities that will be developed that will help them to decide in case that suddenly it will be developed. And I do remember, as head of Amman, chief of defense intelligence in 2006, that when the cabinet met for the first time, a lot of gaps in their knowledge was there that could have been different if they devoted enough time for learning.
So do you think that they should have a course, can we call it that, for new ministers who join the security cabinet? Should they spend the first few months visiting the military, visiting the Mossad, learning up, studying up on these things, getting personal briefings? Is that something that should happen?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, as an anecdote, in 2013, when Prime Minister Bennett was first became a minister, at that time Minister of Economy, if I don't forget, and he became a member of the security cabinet. And coming from being a major in the IDF and a very successful businessman and successful politician, he lacked the level of strategic considerations. And he came to the INSS and spent a couple of days with me learning the Iranian issue, learning the issue of Hezbollah, the relation with the superpowers, the US, Russia, China. Didn't want so much to go deeper into the Palestinian issue that he, I think, he thought that he knew from his time as the chairman of the settlers, but he have done a learning process. So did Meirav Michaeli, so did others, and I really credit them for doing it.
That's interesting, very interesting. Tell me, the last week was 40 years to the OC Iraq bombing. I think you put on your jumpsuit, is that what it's called? The flight suit, maybe, and you got back in the cockpit.
Light suit, yes. And G suit.
Okay, and you got back in the cockpit and you flew as part of recognition of the 40-year anniversary, but together with the graduates of the Israel Air Force's prestigious pilots course, which they got their wings last week. So that's a momentous moment here in Israel as well. You know, looking back on the 40 years, right, what are the key takeaways from that bombing and what Israeli leaders should remember today when they look on the horizon at particularly, I would say, Iran?
I think what should be taken in the highest strategic level is the Begin Doctrine, because the Begin Doctrine was not there. Nobody attacked a nuclear reactor before, not only in the Middle East, in the whole world. And the idea that a preemptive attack to stop a nuclear program is legitimate and should be part of Israel's defense strategy or defense concept was developed by Prime Minister Begin. He says basically any leader in a neighboring country that call for the destruction of Israel and developing a nuclear weapon that will enable him to do it, Israel has the duty to destroy. So this was the first time. It was exercised again in 2007 vis-a-vis Bashar Assad. At that time, I was the head of intelligence, so I saw the process twice, from the cockpit of an F-16 and from the very close decision-making room. So this is the first takeaway. The real hero of this attack were not the pilot, the real heroes. The hero are the decision makers, and Prime Minister Begin that was able to convince his government, and at the end, in consensus, they vote for it. So this is one. Second, if you exercise and plan and replan and re-exercise for a year, operational missions that seems impossible because we didn't have enough fuel, we didn't have air refueling, we have very little intelligence, and the nuclear reactor was well defended by brigades of SA-2, SA-3, SA-6. Iraq was in a war status with Iran, so the alert was very high. And it seems like it's impossible to do the job without losing maybe four out of the eight pilots. But we came with some innovative ideas how to gain or to save more fuel, how to navigate even though we didn't have GPS at that time, and how to penetrate the same missiles. And, you know, the name of the operation at the beginning was Givat HaTachmoshet. And anybody who knows what is Givat HaTachmoshet, the armament hill in Jerusalem.
Ammunition hill, right.
Knows that there were many casualties there.
Right.
We trained for a year, and after the first attempt to launch the airplane was aborted by Prime Minister Begin because of a leak, they changed the name from Ammunition Hill to Opera. And it was a real opera with no casualties, and the mission was accomplished.
Wow. It's an amazing story. And for those who are not familiar with it, there's been books written about it. It's really something that's worth diving into because it's the first time in the world history that a country, Israel, was able to take out one of its enemy's nuclear facilities and prevent that country from getting nuclear weapons. Amos Yadlin, retired Major General, I want to thank you for joining us at the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Thank you and have a wonderful day.
So we're joined now by Mayan Hoffman, our head of strategy at the Jerusalem Post Group and coronavirus analyst, as well as Rosella Turkatin, who is our health reporter, also covers archaeology. But today we're going to talk about this recent infection spike that we've seen across the country, attributed mostly to the what's being called the Delta variant or the Indian mutation, I guess, whatever name you want to call it. But Rosella, you did a story the other day that spoke about the breakdown
of the numbers. Can you just give us a quick overview of how many people are we looking at right now who are sick? What's their age groups? And what does that mean maybe about Israel's vaccination campaign?
We have to say that in the past 2 weeks, the number of active cases in the country has surged from less than 200 to about 1,800, which is a significant increase. Just to give us a way of comparing numbers, last time we were at this number of active cases was around the end of April. What's very interesting is that these current outbreaks started in schools, in Israeli schools, and not in, any schools, but in middle schools, actually, especially among children 12 to 15 years old. What does this mean? It means that a couple of weeks ago, when the numbers started to go up, if we look at the breakdown of the age group of the new cases, we could see a real prevalence of children ages 12 to 15. 67% one day, about 50% the following day. So this cohort actually could have been already partially protected, at least because the vaccination campaign for them started at the beginning of June. And actually the FDA had authorized the vaccine even earlier, the beginning mid-May. But the health ministry in Israel chose to be very careful. It took them a while to decide to approve vaccination for this age group. And even when they did, they didn't promote it. So what happened was that a very few of them started to be vaccinated, and then some of them started to get infected. And one can only wonder what would have happened if most of them or a higher number was already protected.
Well, we've seen Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who's now launched a big campaign to get those teenagers to be vaccinated. I saw just the other day, he posted on Facebook, I was own daughter, who I think is 14, now is getting the shot for the first time. So everyone is kind of waking up to this. But Mayan, do you think that this is part of that story, that we missed maybe that window to vaccinate our young 12 to 15-year-olds? Would that have made a difference? And also talk to us, you did a big piece the other day about what's going on at the airport and how this is like Israel's Achilles heel almost when it comes to importing a lot of the infections and the coronavirus cases. So kind of break that down for us.
Okay, so first of all, I'm not sure that we can say that Israel missed the boat on the 12 to 15-year-olds. I think it's good to be cautious. And we had such low infection in the country at the time when they were giving when they were approving the 12 to 15-year-olds to be vaccinated. It made sense to say, look, only if a person is high risk, only if they live with someone high risk, only if you're traveling out of the country. If you're staying here, you're likely not to get infected. But you mentioned the airports. And what happened was concurrently, at the same time as we were not vaccinating 12 to 15-year-olds, we were not monitoring the airports well. So it was true that if you were in Israel where there was, a few active cases, as, Rosella mentioned, the likelihood of you getting infected was actually slim to none. And why take the risk of getting vaccinated or use those vaccinations if you don't need to, right? Though there were some health experts, I will say at the time, who said, you never know when it's going to come back and maybe you should just preempt the chance of you getting sick. But what happened at the airports is sort of, I guess, what you can say was expected to happen at the airports, because we watched a year and a half of COVID and we watched the airports really be as you said, the Achilles heel, whether it was under former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who didn't manage to shut the airports quick enough to the red states whom we had diplomatic relations with, whether it was encouraging people to go travel to Uman, et cetera, you could cite many examples. Until today, look, Naftali Bennett only took office, it was June 15th, I believe, right? June 14th, the day before a lot of this outbreak really started to surge. So you can't blame the new government for the problems at the airport. You will only be able to blame the new government if they don't fix them. But what we do have right now is that the last government left us with total chaos. Why? I'll tell you in very short. Essentially, we had a company called Check to Fly that's been in place really since November, actively at the airports.
I just did a test with Check to Fly the other day.
And they're excellent, right? Drive in, very smooth, quick, results within 4 to 14 hours. Everything seems to be, really really good. I flew to Dubai not so long ago, there and back, both tests within seconds. Right before Bennett took office, there was a problem with the contract. The health ministry had decided, the previous health ministry, health minister, Yuli Edelstein, had decided that he wanted to take over because now there were mandatory tests, remember, starting in January, February at the airport. The health ministry wanted to be overseeing it as a government testing process rather than a private. And they needed to switch it, but they didn't get their tender out quick enough. And then they went ahead and put in some other company, Femi Premium, who is there now, who really wasn't ready or capable to handle the testing. And overnight, they switched it. Check to Fly was there one day. Check to Fly wasn't there another day. Femi's in. Not enough staff, not enough equipment, mass lines coming into the airport peak. We're in June. Tourists are flying. Israelis are happy. We've opened up and the airport starts to crash again. Bennett, in his credit, went to the airport right away. First place he visited right within the, you know, the COVID upsurge and said, I'm going to deal with it, put Ronnie Numa, as we know, in place. So what's going to happen next is remains to be seen. But yeah, that is where a lot of this started.
What's interesting about the airport, though, is that this was really a problem from the beginning when other countries had already set up testing facilities at their airports. Israel still was lagging behind on that. And it was pretty early on that we understood in the country and the world with dealing with corona that you need to have testing facilities at your airport. And that took time and there were tenders, et cetera. I mean, the other thing I could just say by way of story is, so people who get permission to come into Israel, whether you're a tourist or you've been vaccinated overseas, you have to prove your vaccination, you have to do a serological test. So what a lot of people are doing, I'm hearing this from a lot of tourists, they come, they land in Israel, their cab will stop at a gas station just outside the airport where they'll be met by someone on a motorcycle who will do blood tests to people in the car and then take those blood tests. I mean, it's like we're doing things as if we're still in a shtetl, as opposed to saying, everyone who comes in who claims to be vaccinated, we will have them take a serological blood antibody test at the airport. Like, why is this so hard?
It's so hard because we have not had a proper government during the entire crisis. We went through the coronavirus crisis. I mean, to our credit, it's amazing where we are today, knowing what kind of government was in place during this crisis. So in the previous administration, the tourism ministry, the health ministry, the National Security Council, the prime minister, they did not work together. And so therefore, many of the things that should have been set up that were set up in most of the Western world were not set up in Israel. And that, I honestly think that is the answer, that the health ministry has not been working, even though it is the health ministry, to the professionals' credit, has done an incredible job. I think that it has not been working as efficiently as it could if it had leadership, again, that was supported, that wasn't dealing with the populism that was going on throughout the last administration. I don't want to be too optimistic because I'm not that optimistic of a person, but I would say that I have some hopes based on what I'm seeing now, that some of these things that we have left over from the last administration within a very short time are going to be fixed.
Okay, Rosella, going back to the teenage vaccinations, there's a lot of stories and a lot of people, you know, just talking to friends who have kids around the same age as my friend, as my children. And I vaccinated both of my older two, those who are eligible. I have younger two who are younger under the age of 12, so they can't yet, they're not eligible for vaccines. But a lot of people are saying to me, I have a 14-year-old daughter. And what about fertility, right? Fertility is a big concern for a lot of people. My answer, which is based on complete, and I have no medical background, but my answer is, okay, she's 14. Let's assume she won't have kids for 10 years, at least till she's 24. We'll deal with that when we get there. But that obviously might not be the answer that everyone would like. So what is the story with fertility? What do we know?
For whatever reason, the fears associated with vaccine and the question of fertility have long preceded corona. Like this is a topic that experts cannot fully understand as far as I have learned from them. But it's a very deep fear that people have. Specifically, you know, there is everyone I've spoken to, like, explains that there's no biological reason to believe that the coronavirus vaccine or the mRNA vaccine, which is the type of vaccine that both Pfizer and Moderna have developed against COVID, there's no biological reason to believe that there would be any form of impact on fertility, both for men and for women. That said, people, doctors, experts are still checking. And of course, you know, these kind of like medical studies take time. And so what we have now is just the first studies with a limited number of patients involved and with a relatively short follow-up period. But what has been found is completely reassuring. What has been found is that patients who, for example, have gone through IVF treatment, fertility treatment, the results of the very same cohort went through IVF treatment. They did not conceive. They got vaccinated before going again on an IVF cycle, and they were checked and monitored, both men and women, both members of the couples, in all the process. There was absolutely no difference in terms of all the data. And actually, we can also say that 30% of them in the second cycle after the vaccine conceived, which is considered a pretty high number, experts said. And this is an Israeli study and just an example of how things are really reassuring in this perspective.
One other point on the question on the vaccines. We heard Prime Minister Bennett say the other day that that we have enough vaccines to vaccinate the children, but till the end of July, because these vaccines are going to expire, right? And they have to get their first shot within the next week or week and a half or so they can get the second dose by the end of July when they expire. Do we have more vaccines to fill that in that are coming? Do we know anything about that?
So we know that Israel has another 200,000 doses of Moderna vaccine that are viable also in August. And the problem is that those vaccines have not been approved for people younger than 18, if I'm not mistaken. And therefore, while scientists...
Only Pfizer has been approved for under... I got that. I didn't know that. Okay.
They've appealed for emergency use for kids, but they have not yet received it from the FDA.
Interesting. Okay.
So while the so-called vaccine mix is considered pretty... a pretty good solution by a lot of scientists, and a lot of countries in the world are already practicing it. Even if Israel decided to go and do that, this would not be relevant for 12 to 15. In addition to it,
it would be very controversial for, I think parents would be, who are hesitant already to vaccinate their kids, would be even more hesitant to mix it. Although I saw that Angela Merkel from Germany got a mix. I saw some story. I think she got two different vaccines. Mayan, I'm curious from your perspective, when you look at this new government, right? And you spoke about the failings of the previous government and how Israel doesn't have a stable government. Now we seem to have a stable government. They seem to be working, and that's a good thing. Is there less populism? Do you get a sense that when you're looking at the decisions, there's been one or two Corona cabinet meetings since this government was formed? Do you feel like there's less politics now that are playing a role in all of this?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you, it's not even that I have a feeling, it's that I've actually talked to the experts who are advising the cabinet. There's been one cabinet meeting, and there was also an expert meeting before the coronavirus cabinet meeting a few days prior. And I spoke to a few of the people who sat around the table, and they actually said to me that they feel good, that they feel like they're being listened to, that the data is being evaluated. The professionals obviously are not making the decisions. This is a democracy, and the government makes decisions, but that they do feel that there is a shift in how first of all, in the previous government, you also saw, a lot of infighting among the ministers themselves. So the professionals came, they weren't listened to. And even there was a kind of a camp of, oh, we should listen to the professionals, and a camp of, oh, we shouldn't. And then even within the same party itself, you would see such division and inability to pass any legislation or make any decisions. It's been, again, one meeting and one professional meeting, but the professionals are saying, they're different. It's a different feeling.
Does that have to do with the fact Bennett, we know, famously wrote this book, right? What was it called? How to Beat Corona? How to Beat COVID? So I had a lot of ideas how to do it. Does that background serve him, you think, in that sense?
Look, I think it's a miracle for Bennett to come into office and to be able to have the first real crisis that he's dealing with not be Iran, even though that obviously is an ongoing crisis, but be COVID, knowing that he has the background that he has and believed that he could fight COVID, even though we never actually saw him do it, before taking office. And at this stage, even as he's quote unquote fighting Corona, and, Rosella talks about the increase in cases, I want to make sure it's very clear that in Israel, we have a decrease in serious cases, right? So as we're vaccinated, we're not seeing people going to the hospitals and dying, being set up on ventilators as was happening for the last year and a half. So we're in a much better position, which is why they didn't have to roll out new restrictions. I think that that, yeah, Bennett's background, look, Bennett's a business person. Bennett has always had strategy. You know, in following him from his first years in the education system, he had strategy. He moved up the 5-point math effectively. And these, you know, that's something that today we're not thinking about 5-point math, people, kids taking, you know, enough, doing well enough in math. But I mean, the truth of the matter is that he is, he's analytical and he's thoughtful. And I think that while he, you know, we watched him sort of in the process of getting to this government be a little weak and wishy-washy in terms of not wanting to side one way, not really clear where he stands. It seems that in the end, maybe that was actually a strategic decision and he's won.
It'll definitely be interesting to see how it all plays out. But Rosella, give me your prediction. You know, a lot of our listeners are probably people who were thinking of coming to Israel July 1st when the individual tourists were supposed to be allowed to start entering the country, vaccinated tourists. Because of this new uptick in infections, the government has postponed that program to August 1st. Do you think it'll actually happen in August, or are we going to continue to see this climb in infections and Israel's going to say, you know what, we're actually going to hold that off for good?
So listen, I think that just, you know, few hours after coming office, Interior Minister Ayelet Shaked sent out an announcement that, you know, they were confirming the program and tourists would be allowed in from July 1st, as it was said before. So I think that even this government and also Bennett and Horowitz are really saying how much they want to try to, you know, have minimum impact on daily life. So I think that the government does want to do it. It's going to be a question of whether, you know, this increase in cases, what happens with the serious cases, as Mayan was saying, if there's no increase in serious cases, if the numbers, even in new cases, remain stable, I think that there's a good chance, provided that they manage to fix at least the minimum problems and gaps at the airport. Because if tourists were coming in right now, like real tourists, like much higher numbers that we're seeing, would be a big problem. So I think I am cautiously optimistic that this could happen. Yes,
but you know, through the summer to the coming year, COVID's not behind us, right? We're gonna have to we have to learn to live with this thing for a period of time. But do you think we're gonna have it under control?
Okay, so first I want to say one thing on the airports, then I'll tell you about under control. Bennett, in his 20-step plan, when he rolled out his book, actually has an entire section about wanting to let tourists in. It says that one of the biggest mistakes that the government made, in fact, he made a lot of speeches about this when Netanyahu was in office, was that we blocked off the state of Israel from the Jewish people. And so I do think that they are going to make every effort to try to hit that deadline, because this government believes that tourists, not just tourists, but Jews should be able to come and be in Israel. So I think that the goal is definitely to have it open. With regards to whether COVID is behind us, it's clearly not behind us. Look around the world. We do see, though, that it's as more and more nations are getting vaccinated, right? It is going down in those countries. The ones that have used effective vaccines, Chinese vaccine, and they have a huge number of cases and it's less effective, especially against variants, but in general. But places that have used Pfizer, Moderna, even AstraZeneca, we're seeing a real decline, and the vaccines are working against variants. So I think COVID has not gone probably ever. I mean, let's remember that the flu is not gone forever. There are many, many viruses that come into this world that never leave us. When you talk about living with it, though, we're living with it today. And I'm not wearing a mask, you know, when I'm outside, and I can go to any restaurants and I can go to the movie theater. So there's going to become a point where there'll be enough or few enough serious cases, few enough people dying from the disease, where we're going to say, you know, if you're nervous, wear a mask. If you're older and at risk, you know, be very careful with hygiene. Don't go to certain crowded areas during high corona times. We don't think corona is seasonal. We don't think corona is a seasonal virus, or some people don't, but some people actually believe that we're going to start seeing that it is going to become seasonal. And we're going to watch that. That's often what happens. The first year it's not, the second year it is, and there might be peaks.
And the vaccine is important to note, undergo modifications to meet, just like the flu does every year.
flu, just like the flu vaccine. And we already have, you know, Israel's in a good spot. We ordered enough vaccines to get those boosters. But the latest studies are saying that we've got a year of these vaccines. So rather than, you know, thinking, oh, we're going to need it, you know, in the next few months or more, we might actually have these last longer. But there will be, yeah, there'll be iterations of the vaccines. And I think we're going to get this together. This is a brand new pandemic. It hit the, and worldwide, everybody failed and succeeded in their own ways. And I think that in this year, this is going to be the year of living in the shadow of COVID, living us alongside COVID, and actually coming out of it, right, and being able to be successful despite there being a virus that's new in this world.
And hopefully the last of the new. Mayan Hoffman, Jerusalem Post coronavirus analyst, head of strategy, and Rosella Terkatin, our health reporter. Thank you both for joining the Jerusalem Post podcast.
Welcome to our weekly segment, the Tweet of the Week. This week, we have a tweet from the Knesset channel, which likes to post clips from the Knesset's various committees throughout the day. And this week,
it's like C-SPAN.
Right, exactly. Very similar to C-SPAN. And so their Twitter has all sorts of interesting clips. And this week we had one. The tweet says, quote, "Who are you anyway? Answer me like a good girl," end quote, demanded Miki Zohar from Idit Silman in the Arrangements Committee. So to translate the translation, Miki Zohar is a leading MK in Likud. He was their coalition chairman previously when they were in the coalition. And he was shouting at Idit Silman, who is the current coalition chairwoman and the chairwoman of what's called the Arrangements Committee, which is a sort of temporary committee until the permanent committees are formed in the Knesset. And he told her that she has to answer his questions like a good girl. Now, he is not the first to call Idit Silman basically a child. Previously, United Torah Judaism Knesset member Meir Porush also called her a yalda, a little girl.
Tell us, Lahav, who is Idit Silman? She's a member of Knesset with Yamina, that's Naftali Bennett's party, and she is also de facto, right, she's serving as the chairperson of the coalition, right? So her job is kind of be the whip,
right,
who keeps this coalition, gets them to vote, gets them in the right place at time, make sure that they have all the votes they need to pass legislation. So she's in a pretty high profile role, and she's a relatively, this isn't her first
she's
term
new.
In Knesset, but
yeah.
She is relatively new, right.
It's her second term in the Knesset. But, you know, the terms lately have been very short. So I think she had only been in the Knesset for a few months before this. The irony is that she's only 6 months younger than Miki Zohar. She is 40 and he's 41. But of course, that is irrelevant when somebody is deciding to be sexist. But the cameras always on in the Knesset, and he was caught on camera, and people are taking him to task for it, as they should, as they really should. I mean, Miki Zohar is someone who's always had a big mouth. He's always been a yeller, which, you know, is par for the course in the Knesset, but he should think twice before, you know, being demeaning to a woman in power.
I think it's also, it's a, you know, if we thought for a moment that the new government would have, with its establishment, will have ended the mudslinging that we had gotten so used to for 2.5 years between four different election cycles. That's not the case, right? This is still going on, and it's important to still be vigilant. It's important to still call it out. And I think that all we can do really is hope that our Knesset members will recognize that they do, to an extent, serve as something of a role model for Israeli public and Israeli society, and that if they speak this way, misogynistic and sexist, like the comment that was made by Miki Zohar and Meir Porush the week before, this is something that it's poor education. It's terrible. So I think that we have to do something for these people to recognize that this is just inexcusable and disgusting.
Yeah, unfortunately, this problem precedes the past few years. You know, there are all kinds of incidents of people cursing, pouring water on each other. All right, and that was right. The tweet of the week.
Thanks for being with us. Both Lahav and I are going to be on vacation next week, so we will reconnect the following week at the Jerusalem Post podcast.